Chapter 7. Learning the Ropes. There he is.
Which one?
He's right there, next to Boot, coming up the hall. Dodd heard a crowd of mostly boys talking by the entrance to the kitchen. Few of them looked older than 14, and all of them wore matching uniforms that indicated they would be serving at the feast. They kept pointing their fingers and making quite a fuss over something.
Did you really flip the 12-seater? Asked one boy, his eyes sizing Dodd up as he approached.
Well, I... Dodd started to reply before being interrupted.
How did you do it without horses? That thing's as massive as the hull of a 40-man jack ship. You can't stop it without powers or something.
Dodd couldn't keep track of the questions, for they poured in at him from the bustling crowd like rain.
Are you Zippod in disguise? Inquired a persistent boy, who tugged at Dodd's shirt until he was noticed.
He had unusually large ears, and his military short haircut made them look even bigger.
That's make-believe kid stuff, Juck, jabbed a heavier-set lad, whose face was speckled with freckles.
Everyone knows there's no such person as Zippod in real life. Dodd must have done some tricky moves, like using a high-tech weapon, right? He turned and looked for a nod, adding,
Is that how you did it?
Before Dodd could say no, a girl who appeared to be the youngest in the group raised her voice and shoved two boys aside.
Are you hurt, Dodd? She asked.
Her bright blue eyes and curly hair reminded Dodd of early pictures of his mother when she was 11 or 12.
Aw, come on, guys. Give Dodd some space, insisted a boy, who seemed to be the leader of the younger bunch.
He cleared the way with his arms, pushing people back like a rescuing bodyguard. His name was Toos. He looked about 14 with ruddy cheeks, light brown eyes, and auburn hair that was parted down the center and slicked to his head.
No offense, Donchi, he continued, glancing at the young girl before centering back on Dodd. We all hope you're not hurt, but what I want to know is what Sob's face looked like. You know, when you set him straight. Tell us about that.
The little mob stirred like reporters, asking Dodd more and more questions. It was obvious they had already heard second or third-hand accounts of the day's adventures and had come up with a few conclusions on their own.
Even you wouldn't stand up straight to Sob, would you, Boot? Asked Toos, grinning ear to ear as he turned toward Boot, who was towering behind Dodd.
Toos's comment was less of a question and more of a tease.
You know I would in the twitch of a cow's tail, protested Boot, grabbing the boy around the neck and playfully rubbing one knuckle up and down his spine.
You better watch what you're saying around me, Toos, or you won't be staying in my bunks anymore. And that goes for the lot of you.
Boot started to chuckle as he added a few words in his best stern voice. And you know Buck's been begging to unload you for some time. Ask Bombu to swap you for a whole group of new greenlings from the pots, 400 from Green alone to choose from, and I'm sure we could dip into the other 600 from Rollins Souche. I keep telling Buck we've got to work with you, but he's ready to trade you in, even if it means a swap with Sob's lot of fellow Rawlings.
The mention of Sob drew boos from the group, causing enough commotion to summon four women and two men from the kitchen to see what the ruckus was about.
Why are you all standing about? Asked one lady. The party is nearly ready to start, and I haven't seen you so much as darken the door to get moving on drinks. We have courses to serve, and trust me, kids, the juice won't pour itself.
Miss Mercy, that's what I was just telling these greenlings, fibbed Boot with a smile.
You can talk later when the food's gone, ordered Boot authoritatively to his younger cohorts, furrowing his brow for emphasis. Get on with it. Don't slack when Mercy has a banquet to serve. I promised her the finest help, and that's exactly what I expect to give her. If I hear you've done half a toe from your best, you'll be scrubbing the Benjis for a week. And not just ours.
Dodd noticed Boot slid in a wink at Donchi, who at first looked concerned about the situation, yet smiled calmly when she saw the sign.
Now, Boot, interjected Mercy, don't count on me believing you've gone tough overnight. I know you're as soft as fresh butter in the sun. You can't fool me.
I wouldn't dream of it, Mercy. The crowd of youth dispersed into the kitchen and returned quickly, rolling large round barrels of juice labeled up the side. Apple juice, peach juice, pear juice, plum juice, drudberry juice, grape juice, sweet potato juice, orange juice, quam juice, and dorsal juice. Mercy gave a few quick commands to the girls and then yelled at the boys before they all disappeared through a large doorway into the banquet hall.
That's more like it, she said. And who might this be?
His name's Dodd, Boot quickly answered. He was injured while raiding a ship to recover Highgate's stolen triblot from Dardarius. We just picked him up from Lower Janus this afternoon. Your friend Higa was helping him recover.
Oh, yes. Is he the one that rode with Bamboo? Well, actually, we both rode with Bamboo, but he... Yes, he saved the carriage, exclaimed Mercy, squeezing in front of Boot to get a better view of Dodd. She looked him up and down, approvingly, and continued, You're quite a hero, son. I'm looking forward to you sticking around. I hope you will stay with us for a while, won't you? Dodd nodded his head. He wasn't sure what to say to Mercy. She looked and acted very similar to a fifth-grade teacher, Dodd remembered. Mercy's hair faded from brown curls on top to peppered gray on the lower sides and back, showing signs of her age, 153. As a treader, she didn't look any older than a 50-something-year-old human. She wore a wide apron that stretched tight in the middle of her stomach, right where a homemade oval pocket hid the majority of a browning grease stain. "My pies, Boot. Dilly didn't tell me he was a coosing," she said, grabbing at Dodd's hand. "How come I'm the last to hear about these kinds of things? I see he's sporting the ring. That's fantastic. We need another quick mind around here these days. Tough times with the likes of Dredarius and his kind lurking about. Seems he's got some soapy friends, looking clean but slippery as the mess hall floor during a good scrub. It makes you wish for the days when Twistyard was protected by a tri-blot field. Of course, that's not saying I want to run up and join Commendus in Highgate, especially after what recently happened there. It's just too bad we don't have our own protection anymore." "There you are," said Dilly as she came bursting through the doorway from the great hall. Her eyes were fixed on Dodd. "We can't get started till you come and take a bow for the crowd. Bamboo just asked for you. He'd like you on the platform. They're all chanting your name." Dodd, 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 Dodd. The sound of the throng was spilling over into the hall, though the name wasn't easily recognizable until Dilly explained what the commotion was about. "Well then, my boy," announced Mercy, grinning, "you had better be off. Don't keep them waiting. I'm expecting to get a full story of your heroic deeds, one twig at a time, and firsthand, mind you, before you'll see supper tomorrow. Now be off. Hurry." Dilly grabbed Dodd by the arm and hastily pulled him away from Boot and into the crowd. "Step aside," she said. "We're coming through. Please move. Thank you. Here's Dodd. Please step aside." Dilly didn't realize she was practically dragging Dodd until he tripped over someone's leg and landed face down. It was Sobs. "Consider yourself welcomed," grumbled Sob, turning to a few chuckling associates standing close at his side. The look on his face exuded great pleasure. "I said step aside," shouted Dilly in Sob's face, stomping one foot in defiance. "You obviously can hear about as well as you look. You should go back to Rawl, Sob. It takes more than a ring to be a real coosing. It takes a lot of class, the kind you just don't have." "Oh, like wobbly here?" Sob's pals had a good laugh, and not just at what he had said. Dodd's awkward movements to get up were enhanced by a swift poke in the rear. A young Rawling had jabbed Dodd with a stick while hiding behind a wall of large coosings from Sob's group. They were intimidating, to say the least. "Come on, Dodd," said Dilly in a perfectly civil voice. "Let's leave these rats before something contagious rubs off or crawls out of their hair." One Rawl coosing broke rank momentarily to offer a quick apology to Dilly. He looked handsome, but younger than the others, lanky and self-conscious. When he pushed his way through and stuck out his arm to help Dodd up, Sob shoved him to the floor and gave him a harsh reprimand. "Taunus, your father is helpless to make much out of you, despite his own greatness. I'm sure it won't be long before he'll stop trying." Sob's eyes gloated arrogantly. He glanced at his friends, who all seemed to applaud him. "It must be horribly embarrassing for your family," he continued condescendingly, brushing one sleeve of his expensive white silk shirt. He grinned wickedly as he picked flecks of lint off and rudely dropped them on Taunus, signifying his disdain. "Either learn your place or we'll send you home like this loser." Sob pointed at Dodd and laughed. Dodd continued to struggle until Dilly helped him up. His legs hadn't fully recovered from 3 weeks of sleeping, and the fall made them ache. But despite the humiliation, Dodd smiled. His ridicule didn't seem nearly as bad when he noticed Toos depositing something nasty all over the mean boys' chairs, while their attention was preoccupied with teasing Dodd. It felt like a team effort, and for once, he was on a team that cared about him. Dilly aided Dodd up a few stairs and across the platform. Bamboo's voice echoed throughout the hall. "And here he is!" His frail arm gestured toward Dodd as Dilly pushed him to the center. "Thank you," said Dodd as he faced Bamboo and bowed. He whispered it for Bamboo, not really sure what to say to the throng. However, to his surprise, The center position of the platform was rigged to carry the sound, so it boomed, "Thank you," to the whole room. The crowd went wild. Screams and cheers roared from every corner of the great hall, as though Elvis had just entered the building. Dodd was embarrassed. He stayed in the bowing position for a few moments. Finally, he snuck a peek sideways at the audience. Hundreds of treaders and a sprinkling of humans, drats, and bobwits all stood, many of them waving their arms, in appreciation or acknowledgement. He wondered what exactly Bombu had told them before he entered the room. "You can stand up straight now," whispered Dilly from behind him. Her voice, fortunately, didn't carry as his had. Dodd and Dilly made their way back down into the gathering and were glad to be greeted by a mob of green coosings, led by Boot. "You're the top, Dodd," said Boot with a shiny-faced look. Bombu raised his cane and signaled for everyone to be quiet. The hall went silent. "I wish I only had good news to tell," said Bombu. His voice revealed serious concern. "Drudarius has more followers than we had hoped. Many battles have been fought in Green over the years to stop Drudarius and his father. Nevertheless, despite decimating his army of poorlings, it appears he has obtained a hidden hold on others. Proper diplomacy at a time like this will do more good than many armies of soldiers." Buck leaned over and whispered in Dodd's ear, "He looks pretty serious, doesn't he?" Dodd nodded in agreement. "But I must admit," Buck whispered again, "he sure looks better up there than he would have looked at the bottom of Drop's Cliff. You brought him home." "Shh!" Dilly put her finger to her lips and let Buck and Dodd know she intended to help enforce the silence Bombu had asked for. "We've suspected for some time that people with money were secretly aiding Drudarius," Bombu continued. "They perpetuate hunger in distant lands and then hire the starving humans and drats and bobwits and treaders, all poorlings in his forces. Yet with the most recent poisoning at Highgate and other troubles, including my wagon mishap today, there is added fear that dark men lurk close by. Even..." "That sounds like the works of the Dread," muttered Boot to Dodd and Buck.
"Shh!"
"We have reason to believe," said Bombu in a very ominous voice, "the Dread has returned."
"I knew it," proclaimed Boot, celebrating. He shouldered Dodd and Buck and then gave Dilly an "I told you so" kind of look with his daring eyes, taunting her.
"We've all been suspecting him since the poisoning," retorted Dilly, playfully annoyed. She wouldn't give Boot much credit for stating the obvious. "Papli Honogosa was clearly the key target of the Highgate disaster," she added, pushing her curls over her shoulder. "And who would want him dead more than the Dread? He's the only one who has ever wounded the Dread and lived to tell the tale."
"But I thought the Dread died from his injury 6 years ago," whispered Dilly's little sister, Sonny.
She looked similar to Dilly. However, she had light brown hair with natural highlights, sea-blue eyes, and a slightly younger, naive look to her face. The clothes she wore revealed she was one of the greenlings given a charge for the night to help serve dinner. She had crept up behind the group and was standing close at Dilly's side.
"What?" said Dilly, turning to her sister. It was hard to hear anything with all of the chatter around the room.
When Bombu had mentioned the Dread, it provoked gasps and a chorus of small conversations. The Dread was a villain of evil proportions. So many stories had been told of him over the past 60 years that it was difficult to believe they were all about one man, one evil follower of Doss, one who had sought revenge against Bombu's family and all levels of democracy. The Dread had deeds which were shrouded by cloaks of blackness, and nobody ever lived to tell his true identity. Even Papali Honogoso never saw behind his mask, though others lived to speak of a mysterious man, sometimes hooded, sometimes hidden by the dark, sometimes disguised in daylight. He was a master of deception.
"Be aware that these are dangerous times," emphasized Bombu cautiously. "If the Dread is really behind Drudarius and his forces, we have worse troubles than the occasional battles that Pius is capable of fighting with his seasoned soldiers. Truly, there are worse troubles from money and policy problems generated by a few critical acts, the sort the Dread is capable of, than all of the damage that could be inflicted by an open assailant like Drudarius and his men. And if it is the Dread, Rahl and Soosh are both in danger, too." Jim poked his head through the crowd and joined the conversation with Dodd, Dilly, Buck, and Boot. "The Dread is our top enemy in Soosh," he said eagerly.
"And Doss?" interjected Dilly. "Well, since Doss was destroyed, the Dread took over. He got the noble Treader families in a fight with each other. Plumes, Hoths, Pelts, Sandsters, Daleks,
and also my lot, the Griggs. It was hard restoring democracy after that. He wiped out half of the educated population by getting them to fight against each other for 10 years, and he didn't even have to raise an army. His well-placed assassinations and bribes led to a decade of chaos before Humbaron stopped him. Of course, that was 22 years ago. They haven't seen him in Sush since then. The look on Jim's face matched the sobering atmosphere in the crowd. It wasn't much of a celebration feast, at least not after the announcement about the Dread. Bamboo went on to reassure everyone that he wasn't trying to scare people. He just expected them to increase their abilities and be willing to help out when needed. At the conclusion of his comments, he declared that he had rejected Commendus's request to move Twistyard inside the protection of Highgate. That announcement was met with universal cheers and sighs of relief. Nobody wanted to leave Bamboo's house. Later that evening, Dodd was shown around by Boot, Dilly, and Buck, before being escorted to his new bunking quarters. The size of the main building was larger than any castle he could have imagined. Over 1,500 people could easily be seated in the banquet hall, and there were adjoining kitchens and accessory rooms to aid in food preparation and entertaining. The front of the great hall opened up directly to a grand courtyard of lush grass, lined with trees, and beyond the trees there were barns, cottages, and other useful buildings encircling the complex, like a giant wall in a semicircle formation, with Lake Modge on the remaining side. Within the house, there were dozens of large rooms used for study and practice by Bamboo's guests at Twistyard. The library alone was a 23-story terraced room that held more books than most university collections. Off the main corridors, halls led to less commonly used areas. Conference rooms, temporary boarding rooms, and bunks for the long-standing members at Twistyard. "Here we are," said Boot dramatically. "You'll want to remember the two large swords hanging from the ceiling. It's a good prompt that this is your stop. If you try the hall just before this one, you're likely to get an embarrassing welcome from the all-girl extended bunking quarters of Potts. They've got nearly 200 of them stashed next door." "And I'm sure you've tried missing this door a time or two," ribbed Dilly. "Not me," insisted Boot, flipping his thumb in his brother's direction. "It's Buck that's had a tough time." "You're always blaming everything on me," exclaimed Buck, getting lightheartedly annoyed. "I haven't seen an inch beyond those doors." "So, they blindfolded you too," answered Boot mischievously. "I knew it! You boys are all alike pathetic," exclaimed Dilly. "My great-grandpa would be embarrassed if he knew how you trifled with his rules of conduct, like they were a game to be played." "As I was saying," declared Boot with one hand in the air, "keep your eyes out for these brilliant swords. They're our symbol. If you go one door down, you'll need an answer to Sob, and from the likes of your encounters, I'm assuming you'd rather steer clear of him." "Good night," spouted Dilly as she stormed through the big doors below the swords and disappeared to the left. "Quite a spunky spirit," remarked Buck. "Oh, I think she's bossy enough to run the place, don't you?" said Boot, jabbing Dodd in the ribs. Yep, replied Dodd. However, his mind was elsewhere. He couldn't take his eyes off the two swords that hung from the ceiling. Their golden sparkle entranced him. "All 50 greenlings and now 15 green coosings are bunking here," continued Boot. "Of course, the girls are to the left where Dilly just went in. They have lakeside view rooms. The rest of us bunk down in those rooms." Boot's hands pointed back and forth, indicating as he spoke. "But don't set your heart on ever seeing a glimpse of Lake Modge from the girls' quarters," added Buck. "Their hall door is always locked." Buck and Boot walked through the entry as Boot continued describing their surroundings. He even had plenty to say about the strange painting of a purple flower which hung on the wall near the entrance. "What are you waiting for?" asked Buck, when he noticed Dodd was still lingering in the larger hallway. Boot stopped his monologue to turn and look. "Who hung these swords?" questioned Dodd. His eyes were fixed on them. There was something familiar, something he couldn't quite put his finger on. "Let's see. I think it was Bamboo," said Boot. "Yep, now I remember. It was definitely Bamboo. He hung them about 13 years ago to remind us that we could increase our sword skills faster from believing in ourselves than we could from sparring hopelessly with Sob and his lot. It's ironic that he hung them above our door instead of Rawl's. They used them to torment us. Rawlings are naturally good at swordplay, with Rawl Cousings being the best. As a group, we haven't ever won in tournaments against them." "That's not true," said Dilly through the girl's door. "She's always listening," exclaimed Buck, knitting his brows. The door opened up and Dilly emerged. Well, we aren't that good at swordplay, but Bombu didn't hang the swords. He lectured us and then asked Papali Honogoso to help us out. Remember? He's the one that set the swords. To rub it in the faces of those cocky dregs from Rawl.
Oh, I remember. You're right, said Boot. As always, groaned Buck hopelessly.
Thank you. Good night again. Dilly was gone as fast as she had appeared. The information didn't crack the mystery of the swords, so Dodd was disappointed, though he knew if he kept thinking about it, the answer would come.
Let's go, Dodd, said Boot, yawning. It's getting late, and you've had a long day.
Wait, shouted Dodd.
Shh, insisted Buck. Dilly will be back any minute to lecture us on nighttime voices if you yell like that again.
Dodd complied by lowering his volume. Does Zerny have a scar on his hand? He eagerly asked. Unanswered questions clamored for attention in his mind.
I don't think so, replied Boot.
You wouldn't know with the black gloves he's always wearing, added Buck.
Don't you mean white? Asked Dodd.
Nope, definitely black, and I don't even need Dilly to help me respond to that one.
Obviously you do, chimed Dilly through the door. He was wearing white gloves today.
She fussed with the handle for a few seconds before swinging it open. I know he was wearing white, not black. Now can we all go to bed?
We're hardly stopping you, grumbled Buck, who was slightly sore about being told he was wrong for the 100th time in a row. He always wears black. I'm sure he was wearing black today.
Actually, Dodd admitted hesitantly, I saw him wearing white gloves while driving the horses home from the hospital. Dilly beamed a bright, hardly tired smile and walked 5 steps across the hall to give Dodd a light hug from the side.
The boy speaks the truth, she said frankly.
Why white gloves? Asked Boot. I don't get it. His work is outdoors. He would soil right through a pair a day.
Well, this afternoon, explained Dilly, he soiled his black pair on the way to the hospital. He asked me if I had a spare. It was while we were waiting for Dodd to wake up. I didn't, of course, but the nurses were kind enough to find some for him to use.
Did you happen to see whether or not he had a scar in his hand? Asked Dodd eagerly.
No. It wouldn't be proper for me to have him take his gloves off in my presence. And if he did, certainly I wouldn't look. His family works the land for mine. It would be a dishonor to both of us.
Oh, said Dodd, glancing down and noticing some dirt under one of his fingernails. Is it wrong that I openly display my hands?
Dilly, Boot, and Buck all laughed.
You're funny, Dodd, said Dilly. I think I'm going to like having you around, so long as you support my side against them.
She pointed a condemning finger at Boot and Buck, yet it was obviously a playful gesture.
Boot and Buck showed Dodd down a hall that was lined with rooms on both sides. Snores and quiet chatter filled the air. At the end of the hall, Buck unlocked their private quarters. Inside was a large, uncluttered room, about 30 feet by 50 feet, and it only had 3 beds.
You'll be bunking in here with me and Buck, said Boot. Some of the other guys may complain about you jumping rungs up the ladder to this, but I'll happily explain it to them with sticks on the court. Just let me know.
Boot quickly got ready for sleeping and made his way to bed.
The room was larger than Dodd would have expected, considering Twistyard had over 1,000 short-term guests as pots, and a combined 200 resident guests as Rawlings, Sushlings, Greenlings, and Coosings. And that's without counting any of the instructors, aides, dignitaries, or temporary guests.
So how did you get this nice pad? Asked Dodd curiously.
Seniority, said Buck. Boot's been here longer than any of the other Coosings, even longer than Dilly. A full 21 years as a Coosing, 9 as a Greenling, and 2 as a pot.
Wow, that's a long time. What about you, Buck?
I've been a Coosing for 12. Of course, Boot's my brother. He can set anyone straight in a fair match with sticks, and he's about the best at everything else, too.
See why I keep him around, marked Boot with a smile.
Except not when it comes to swordplay and Rawlings. Buck, you didn't need to throw that in.
And flying on stuff, because he doesn't prefer heights.
That's about enough, Buck.
And then there's Balurse.
Buck!
He hasn't ever been on a winning team, and Twistyard has had 12 since he's been here. 6 straight from Sush until they banned instructors from playing, and the last 6 all in a row from Rawl. They've become unbeatable, though I guess it makes Twistyard look good.
Boot hit Buck with a pillow, and that was the end of the conversation.
Dodd's bed was against one wall, with Boot and Buck's lining the opposite. At the front of the room, a large window climbed to 15 feet in the middle from 10 feet on the sides. It gave a perfect view of some grassy playing fields below. By the light of an unusually large moon, Dodd could see the white cliffs in the distance that had almost taken his life. "Not today," he mumbled to himself, climbing into bed with his clothes and shoes on. "Aren't you going to at least remove your shoes?" asked Buck with a chuckle. Dodd didn't even respond. He lay down and closed his eyes. "He's awfully tired," remarked Boot to Buck as he got up and walked across the room to open up one of the sliding panes at the bottom of the large window. A slight gust of air blew through the room, cooling things down. Everyone got comfortable and headed off to sleep. However, it was only for a few moments. "That's it," said Dodd, sitting up. The smell of the air reminded him of sleeping by the river's edge. "I know that knot back there." He pointed excitedly toward the door where the hall led to the location of the two hanging swords, above Greenhall's entrance. "That's Pap's triple-cinched double-loop knot. Nobody ties a knot like that but Pap." "You're not kidding," grunted Boot, who was startled into partially waking up. "Pap's a hero." "You know Pap?" "Who doesn't? Around here, a lot of the training we've received over the past 15 years has come from that old man. He's a legend." "Yep," added Buck sleepily. "One of Bombu's best friends." "Well, why didn't anyone tell me about Pap?" "What do you mean?" said Boot. "We've mentioned him all night. Remember at the banquet? We said he's the only one who's ever bested the Dread. And then just barely we decided he's the one who hung the swords." "I thought Dilly said some Papalee guy hung them at Bombu's request." "Yes, it would be Dilly that can actually pronounce his full name. The rest of us always called him Pap." "Where is he?" asked Dodd. Sleep had fled from his eyes completely, snubbed out by the excitement over Pap. "Dodd, can we talk about this tomorrow?" begged Boot. "No, please tell me where Pap is." There was a long silence. Dodd looked out the window at the landscape and couldn't believe Pap was out there, or at least had been there. "Come on, Boot, tell me about Pap." "I really think Dilly should be the one, because pickles are, you know, how drats look that way." Boot was too far gone to ask, and Buck was making obnoxious snoring noises, so it was pointless addressing him. Dodd had to wait. "I guess I'll try in the morning," he said to himself. "Besides, maybe I'll wake up someplace else, like my own bed. And if not, I'll figure this whole thing out once and for all." Dodd continued to mumble to himself long into the night, long enough to still be tired when Rooster started crowing. Regardless, sleep didn't hold him captive for long, or at least not after he opened his eyes enough to see what was right in front of him.